From Harrisburg to Erie, Pittsburgh to Port Allegheny, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, state government has moved quickly to rebuild an I-95 bridge in Philadelphia, which collapsed after a tanker crashed and caught fire beneath it. It shows how rapidly projects can get done when regulators get out of the way. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And unable to persuasively sell their policies, the left has made protesting and name-calling their go-to tactics. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania's three constitutional or row offices will be on the ballot next year. State Treasurer Stacey Garrity and State Auditor General Tim DeFore are eligible for and expected to run for second terms. But the Office of Attorney General will be open as Josh Shapiro resigned the position to become governor and Michelle Henry is serving the balance of his term. A third Democrat has entered the race. Keir Bradford Gray is a public defender from Montgomery County and has thrown her hat into the ring. She joins former State Auditor General Eugene DePasquale and Bucks County Solicitor Joe Kahn in seeking the Democratic nomination. There are no official entries yet on the Republican side, but York County District Attorney David Sunday and former U.S. Attorney Bill McSwain, who mounted an unsuccessful campaign for governor last year, are likely candidates for the GOP. Counties and municipalities will be receiving nearly $279 million in funds from the impact fee assessed on companies operating in the Marcellus Shale region. That is an increase of almost $50 million from last year. In addition to plumping up county and municipal coffers, some of the funding is placed into the state's Marcellus Shale Legacy Fund. Struggling with an escalating crime problem, officials in Philadelphia now say they plan on hiring 300 additional police officers over the coming year. According to the Center Square, City Council's Committee of the Whole recently granted preliminary approval for a $6.2 billion budget for fiscal 2024, which starts on July 1st. The budget includes $3 million for police officer recruitment and $1.5 million to further develop the city's cadet program. There were a total of 84,274 criminal offenses committed in Philadelphia in 2022, up from 65,120 in 2019. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Josh Shapiro responded to the collapse of a bridge on I-95 in Philadelphia by personally taking charge and leading an effort that got a temporary structure in place within days. This calls into question the maze of regulations and approvals that usually take years of efforts to do such a project. Our Capital Watch crew is here to talk about it and to give us an update on the state budget talks. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation and Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars from the Commonwealth Foundation, Vice President Steve Bloom. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. Fantastic to be here.
And always, it's a great pleasure to be with Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, great to see you too.
Good to be here again, David. Thank you.
Well, we've had all kinds of excitement over the past days since last you heard from us. And I suppose the one really spectacular, unavoidable bit of news was the truck explosion in Philadelphia that brought down a chunk of I-95 and actually disabled that major roadway in both directions. So, Rebecca, I know that you've been on the scene monitoring this very closely for your industry. What can you report about how things are going in Philadelphia?
Yeah, well, I've been talking about that, as you can imagine, for 2 weeks now. I-95 is a major freight corridor along the Eastern Seaboard. Obviously carries a lot of products, and people travel it up and down the Eastern Seaboard quite a bit. connects the southern part of the United States to New England and the eastern part of the U.S. It is a very critical corridor. And unfortunately, that accident that happened last Sunday, we lost a truck driver in that accident, unfortunately. And hopefully we'll find out what the cause of that accident
was. Investigators don't know why or how it happened.
No, exactly. But he was coming off the highway off an exit ramp and slammed into the wall at the bottom of the exit ramp. And the explosion of the tanker truck that was carrying unleaded gasoline to a local, I believe it was a Wawa, to supply them, it exploded and blew up one side of the bridge at the highway, and the other side was rendered impassable because it was damaged so much. So essentially, we had a hole in Interstate 95, made it completely impassable for most of the, well, for the last 2 weeks, actually.
Right. Governor Shapiro has really stepped into action. I think he recognizes this as being the first major crisis of his administration, and he sure has grabbed the bull by the horns.
I have to really commend the state and federal and the local governments for really working hard on managing this situation. Because obviously there's a lot of traffic that passes on that road. Well, 14,000 trucks, 160,000 vehicles a day. So about 9% of that was trucks that I've been sort of focused on. But that's a significant amount of traffic that they had to detour. So working on the detours and working on managing that traffic, getting around the incident and around that portion of the road. But then also, of course, working on finding a solution to getting the highway up and running again. And they have really succeeded in that. By the time we air, the highway actually may be open this weekend. So,
which is astonishing, because the initial analysis was that it was expected to be closed for months.
Yeah, the first analysis was, when this first happened, was they said several months. A few days later, they were talking about a matter of a couple of weeks at the earliest. And then just this week, the governor came out and announced it would be open by the weekend.
Yeah.
So everybody's jaw sort of dropped. And that's incredible, because an incident like this with the damage done to a major highway open in 2 weeks, we really need to commend them for that. That's amazing.
Well, and Steve, it just puts me in mind of, well, what standard procedures did they suspend to be able to execute this so quickly?
Right, David. It's interesting because, of course, and I too commend the governor for making things happen quickly to repair and reconstruct this vital artery that's critical to our economy here in Pennsylvania and surrounding states and beyond. But the question that it raises for me is, okay, so normally this process might take months or sometimes even years to correct major structural damage to a massive interstate highway system. Instead, it's going to take a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What that tells me is that many of the layers of red tape that normally prevent swift action on the part of private construction companies or those contracting with the government or government agencies that have to approve things, those layers of red tape were cut right through.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I think it's very much merited, but it illustrates the difference. 2 weeks versus months and months of delay. That's an unintended glimpse for us into what Pennsylvania could be like if we could reform the regulatory system we have and cut away some of this permanently, some of this red tape.
Yeah.
Prevent there from every construction project turning into a long, difficult jog for months and months and months, just getting basic approvals and then inspections and one thing after another, some of which is important, but the amount of regulation we have in Pennsylvania is stifling compared to other states.
The governor has done well, leveraging his relationship with the Biden administration, working with Mayor Kenney in the city, and putting a webcam 24/7 on the site to say,
so now let's,
we are watching you.
Yeah. Let's apply this lesson to some other projects. Let's keep this going.
That's great. Now, to be fair, the two-week solution is a temporary one. They actually are filling in the hole with backfill. And that's a great story, too, I want to talk about in a second.
Please.
But in a second here. But this solution is temporary. But to Steve's point, he also said that he expects that the permanent bridge will be in place within a couple months. So even that couple of months is just incredible, given the amazing amount of lengthy time it takes to get something like that done through a typical process. And we've seen that. There's lots of construction projects going on in the state right now because of the federal infrastructure money. It's always held up by, you know, environmental regulations, environmental surveys that must be done, public comment periods that last for, you know, certain periods of time. And all of those things add up often sometimes to years and years. So all of those things, if there's a way to speed them up, get them, you know, through that process quicker, we can look at getting these projects done in months rather than years. And it's a great point.
Yeah. Talk about the backfill.
Yeah. So I want to mention this because we like to talk here on the show about Pennsylvania and how great Pennsylvania companies and Pennsylvania economy is. So I really want to give props because the temporary solution that they put into place is they actually trucked in about 100 truckloads of recycled glass aggregate, which was manufactured in Delaware County and has been used in other transportation infrastructure projects elsewhere. But this backfill is going to be has been put into place, and they're gonna pave three lanes over top of the aggregate.
Okay.
And open those three lanes in the middle on each side. Mm-hmm. And then they're gonna build the permanent structure on the outside of each of those three lanes. When they complete the permanent structure on the outside, they'll close down the middle three lanes, remove the aggregate, and then continue building the middle lanes of the bridge while their traffic is routed on the outside. So the cool thing about this is that aggregate, like I said, produced in Pennsylvania, moved by Pennsylvania trucks, and Pennsylvania contractors are on the job. So I really, eyes of the nation here on Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania came through.
Outstanding.
So and really proud of that.
Absolutely. As well, we should all be. It goes all the way from, Boston and north through, through New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, through Baltimore, Washington. And I think it goes all the way to Miami.
Yeah. The one thing about this one particular section of 95, which made it interesting, we're fortunate in some ways that there are kind of a lot of ways around this section of 95. You can go up to 95 around the Jersey Turnpike. You can take the Pennsylvania Turnpike if you like. But the reason this particular section was critically important is it's the way that companies in Pennsylvania get their goods out to the national market, and also how they get products from the national market into, you know, raw materials and things into their own manufacturing facilities and their own businesses. So this link was a really critical highway to getting Pennsylvania goods in and out of market there. So I'm really happy that we're going to see it open here again soon.
Yeah. Well, that's the good news story. And we can proceed to other news that perhaps isn't nearly so conclusive or nearly so much fun. So the budget process is underway in the Capitol. And Steve, why don't you give us an update on where that stands?
Sure. Quick overview. So June 30th is the budget deadline in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's looming.
Yes.
Very close. And we had back in the latter part of the winter, Governor Shapiro proposed his first state budget, and it was on the order of almost $46 billion in spending, which would have been about a 6% increase over last year's budget.
Mm-hmm.
But then more recently, just in the last few weeks, the House of Representatives, controlled by the Democrats by one vote, mm-hmm. 102 to 101, passed a budget of their own, which drastically exceeded the spending levels that Governor Shapiro had proposed by over $1 billion,
mm-hmm.
creating literally a 14% increase in spending over the current year. Spending an additional 14% when we were already looking at, under Governor Shapiro's initial proposal, roughly a $3 billion deficit for each year under a budget like that.
Right.
Now you're cranking that up with no new revenue sources.
Right.
Or you're going to have to go get new revenue sources shortly, right, because you can't spend on that level and face a deficit year after year and still expect to be able to run the economy without increasing taxes. So this is the trap that the Democrats right now in the House have tried to set. The action falls to the other end of the Capitol now,
mm-hmm.
with the Senate of Pennsylvania, which is led by a Republican majority, and it's really up to them to be the sentinels, the watchdogs, to prevent this drastically bloated budget from becoming law and proposing something more reasonable that actually will support sustainably Pennsylvania's economy.
Yeah, and porking up the baseline of spending is dangerous because when once that's accomplished, everybody expects that same amount of money the following year plus a little more. And as we've tried to explain on the show previously, Pennsylvania has a structural deficit, which is driven by demographics. That what that means is that our mandatory spending, the spending that we absolutely have to have, there's no backing out of it. Programs for folks who senior citizens and the poor, other people in need, like that's mandatory spending, and whatever the bill is, we got to pay it. Well, that obligation continues to increase at a pace faster than the natural growth of our economy. And so this structural deficit is one of the biggest – is probably the biggest challenge that state government has to face when we loosen the purse strings. And obviously this example here is well beyond that. This is like chucking away money with both hands, just because it's there, that we can't let that happen just because – what is the old saying? Like if you're in a hole, the first thing you got to do is stop digging. It's like even if you can't fix a problem, the first thing you should do is not make it worse.
Exactly.
So
and you look at the cost drivers, some of the factors. You mentioned a few. The biggest single cost driver that's putting Pennsylvania in a more difficult situation every year is the expense of Medicaid.
Right.
And human services under that broader umbrella of public welfare.
And let the record show that Governor Tom Wolf dramatically expanded access to Medicaid, which increased the state ranks, included people, because that program was meant for poor seniors and people with disabilities and poor young mothers. Like those were the three categories of folks that were meant to be the beneficiaries of these programs. Then the Obama administration went and disengaged all the safeties and basically tried to bribe the states into expanding their roles to pay those benefits to able-bodied single men, and that's where we are now.
And to be clear, I don't think any of us on this show think that it's not appropriate to have a social safety net, including
of course
provision for those types of individuals you mentioned who are vulnerable to have access to medical care. That's important. That's part of who we are as a society.
Yes, sir.
But this just went completely out of control and began to really undermine the incentive systems built into our economy as people could get access to these benefits, which are being paid for by other people who are actually working,
yes,
not working or working very little of their own choice, and pushing this massive burden onto the taxpayers. It is not sustainable. It is putting us into a deeper hole every year. And as I said, even under Governor Shapiro's more modest than the House Democrats' budget, there was already a baked-in budget annual deficit of on the order of $2.5 to $3 billion. It's going to get worse if we don't fix those cost drivers.
What other issues are tangled up? What do you expect to be dealt with, addressed in the course of these budget proceedings?
Well, we know some of the key parties to the budget negotiations have their own desires to move other laws and new pieces of legislation, wrap them into the budget negotiation process and get objectives they've been trying to achieve. For the House Democrats who passed their budget, the other thing they just passed was a massive increase in Pennsylvania's minimum wage laws.
Yeah.
So that would set off minimum wage increases phased in over several years in Pennsylvania. You could see that become a bargaining chip at the table.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there are some really important school choice initiatives on the table that in particular Senate Republican leadership has been talking about a lot, as well as phasing out some of Pennsylvania's burdensome corporate taxes that are making us uncompetitive with other states.
Right, and to try to help to encourage that growth, it's going to close that structural deficit by having more robust expansion
exactly.
of the private economy to pay our bills.
Aimed at juicing up the economy so we can get out of that structural deficit scenario. So you'll see that as part of the discussion. Governor Shapiro may have things of his own that he will put on the table in addition to more funding for public schools and sort of some changes in the structure of how that funding is distributed. But we have yet to see, even though June 30th looms so close, we have yet to see the real outlines of the budget negotiation unfold, and I'm sure in the coming days we will.
Yeah. Well, the issue that really concerns the manufacturers right now is, of course, energy production, energy availability, and pricing, and that the biggest challenge to that, the most urgent challenge, is the leftover electricity tax from the Wolf administration, this regional greenhouse gas initiative, carbon tax on electricity generation, and that it's been announced that the Homer City Generation Station in Indiana County, which is a coal-fired power plant, that it is going to close. They're going to turn it off 1st of July. And this was the outcome that we were trying to avoid. Like, this is even before the court ruling is handed down as to the constitutionality of the program. And we believe we are absolutely certain that this is unconstitutional because it's a tax and not a fee, and that the taxing power belongs exclusively to the legislative branch of government. But like, the damage is going to be done. And unless Governor Shapiro withdraws, us from REGI, like, immediately, like, as you're listening to this, it's going to be too late. We'll weaken the reliability of the grid and increase the risk of rolling blackouts, which we only barely avoided back in December. And so, this is one more case of Pennsylvania getting it, like, exactly wrong. We need this to be addressed as urgently as fixing I-95, that this is an issue where saving those power plants, and because there's nothing wrong with them, they're in full compliance with DEP and EPA. These facilities are major employers, major taxpayers. Like, if these plants are forced closed, that it's going to be a massive hit to the local economy, and that's just not fair and not right. Sadly, we're running out of time here, but as ever, it's great to be together with you folks. Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you're doing?
They can find us and information about I-95 on PMTA.org.
Outstanding. Thank you. And Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and Pennsylvania's foremost free market think tank?
Please find us at CommonwealthFoundation.org on the web.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at PAManufacturers.org and on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on the Pennsylvania Cable Network with PMA Perspective. So from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Once upon a time, Americans debated public policy in passionate yet civil discourse. The Constitutional Convention that founded the Republic and the Lincoln-Douglas debates 40 years later exemplify that great tradition. No more. The American left has abandoned reasoned discourse, largely because its ideas have proven to be abject failures, in favor of throwing violent public temper tantrums, candy-coated by the legacy news media as protests, coupled with name-calling designed to cancel those with whom they disagree. With public pushback against woke ideology growing more intense by the day, the left is seeing its socialistic policy goals slipping from their grasp. As a result, a sort of hysteria has set in as they double down on protest and name-calling. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many parents saw for the first time what government-run schools were teaching their children. They did not like what they saw. That spawned a new wave of activism as parents fought back against everything from critical race theory to the promotion of so-called gender-affirming transitions. Among the parental rights groups that have developed is Moms for Liberty. Their advocacy on behalf of their own children has been highly effective. It has panicked the education establishment, which is seeing a credible challenge to its ability to indoctrinate leftist policies and values into students. So successful has been Moms for Liberty that the far-left Southern Poverty Law Center, SPRC, an extremist group posing as a civil rights watchdog, has designated the parental organization as a hate group. The SPRC's stick is to hang the hate label on any group that opposes its far-left agenda, and of course, the legacy media plays along, pretending that it is somehow a fair arbiter of hate. In fact, the SPRC hates so many other organizations, it should declare itself to be a hate group, which in fact is what it is. When not name-calling, the go-to tactic of the left is to protest. A combination of radicalized activists and paid agitators stand at the ready to protest any government action, political candidate, or conservative speaker with whom they disagree, which is to say all of them. Protesters are aided and abetted in their tactic by the legacy media and frequently by so-called institutions of higher learning. Swimmer Riley Gaines, who has become the public face of opposition to biological males competing in Williams sports, Daily Wire commentator Michael Knowles and podcaster Cabot Phillips were recently scheduled to participate in a debate on such issues at the University of Pittsburgh. Note, a debate, an exchange of views, not a speech. Protesters descended upon the Oakland campus, becoming violent to the point of setting off an incendiary device and resulting in a substantial police response. The University of Pittsburgh then decided to bill the conservative organizations that organized the debate for the security required to quell the violence of the protesters. So now, not only are conservative voices frequently barred from campus, then subjected to violent confrontation when they do appear, but are now being charged for the lawless behavior of protesters, all of which is designed to stifle the First Amendment free speech rights of conservative students. This at taxpayer-funded institutions. The left also thrives on misdirection and misperception. A currently in vogue talking point is that democracy itself is at risk because of the rise in voices opposing its agenda. The events of January 6, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol have become a rallying cry, and while those events were certainly disgraceful, they were an anomaly. Far more frequent have been left-wing disruptions of government proceedings. In 2011, more than 100,000 protesters, most labor union-affiliated, stormed the Wisconsin state capitol in protest of Governor Scott Walker's collective bargaining and budgetary reforms. In Tennessee, far-left lawmakers actually protested on the state house floor, leading to their expulsion from the chamber, an action which triggered even more protests. And, of course, who can forget the Black Lives Matter riots that broke out in cities across the nation in 2020? Again, the legacy news media portrayed the protests as mostly peaceful, this while business districts and neighborhoods in our cities went up in flames. As the 2024 presidential election campaign gets underway, the nation is divided on a wide range of issues, both economic and cultural. It is crucial that conservatives not cave into the left's tactics. Ignore the name-calling. Disregard the noise created by protests. Talk past them to the vast majority of Americans who are hungry for real solutions to the many challenges facing our nation. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WBXQ-FM, WKMC-AM, and WBRX-FM in Altoona, along with WIOO-FM and Red 102.3-FM in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.